been trying to figure that out for 400 years myself. As a matter of fact, that's undoubtedly the chief preoccupation of every living man, at least in the United States today, is trying to figure out what it is. Yes, I know. It's deep in the heart there. Come to think of it, that has sinister overtones as well as... Of course, when you get overtones of reality, you've got to get sinister. There's just no doubt about it. It's there is a considerable amount of truth in that. I'm riding in the plane, you know. I'm sitting in this plane, and we're hanging in the sky. What a day for flying. I just got in. I cannot tell you what a magnificent day it was for flying. It was a great day, but what a day for flying. And I was hanging in the air about 8,000 or 9,000 or 10,000 feet. Where were we? Let's see. It was between Washington and New York, just sort of hanging out there. There was a lot of water and a lot of houses and stuff under there. You know, there's stuff there. You see, and I'm looking out, and I can see the cars going all over in the place, and the trains and the people walking around down there, and the sun is coming down, and I'm in this turboprop, and it's chopping away there. And every once in a while, we hit a big bump. There were about 40 people in this plane, and it must have sat 120 or something. It's a great big baby, you know. And there were nothing but empty spaces between all of us. This is when you begin to examine your navel, I'll tell you. No, it's the truth. You're in an airplane, boy, and you're flying at 8,000 feet, and she hits a big hole in the ground there, and it goes down. And everybody sort of hunches down in their seat because, you know, there's no feeling of togetherness in a plane where there's nobody sitting. There's just a few of us sitting in there. Well, I had been up for about 400 straight hours. As a matter of fact, I have not slept until since the last time that you heard the show, which was, it was 2 weeks ago Tuesday, wasn't it? Last time you heard the show? Well, it's been about since that time that I have slept. I have not slept since. And so I'm looking down there, and you begin to have startling moments of frightening insight after you haven't slept for a while. Now, I don't know whether this is insight or whether or not your brain is separating from your mind and operating independently, and your brain is sort of working down there just like a pancreas or a liver. It becomes an organ, you see. And your mind is sort of floating out like an inflated beach ball above your head. I haven't slept for 36 hours, you see. Okay, so I'm sitting in the plane, and about every 8 or 10 minutes, we hit one of these holes in the air there. We go, ooh, like that. I look down, and the ground comes up a little closer, and the turboprops dig in, and up we go again. Well, this chick, who is the stewardess, you know, she's walking up and down there, and she's trying to hawk magazines. And I am not in a magazine-reading mood, and she keeps bugging me. She keeps grabbing my elbow and saying, do you want to read Better Homes and Gardens? And I don't want to read, you know? And I says, no gardens. And then she, no, I never get sick in an airplane. I just get teed off. So she walked on past back to the John, and then she came back again. She bugged me. She says, you want to read Time? I says, no time, madam, no time to read Time. No time. So she walked on up to the front. Turned around, she came back, she says, you sure you won't want any more of this instant coffee? I make it specially here, you know, it's a little machine that makes instant coffee. I said, no instant coffee, please. And I'm looking out of the window there, and I'm trying to fall asleep. Well, you know, this is ridiculous. Never once in a while, we go down another 400 feet, and the old plane digs in again. So finally, I said, all right, I'll read something. What do you got? She says, well, we got the Wall Street Journal. You look like a successful man on the way up. Just then we hit a big hole in the air, and down we go another 400 feet on the way down. Kills them all. That's one good thing about flying. Successful guys and unsuccessful, a whole lot of them. So that's the leveler. So we go on back. We go on, you know, that's one good thing about flying, you know. There's no private cars in flying. So we dig our way back up to the top again, and finally I get a hold of this paper. I says, okay, I'll read the paper for crying out loud. So I'm reading the paper. Not 30 seconds after I read the paper, then I'm confronted with this enormous headline, and it's in an ad, and it shows, you know, the beautiful picture of the trees, and it's got a little bench there, and you can see what looks like in the far distance in this picture. It looks like houses or something. Just a lovely picture of a pastoral scene, and we're chopping our way over Philadelphia or Ogunquit or someplace. I don't know. What are those places in between Washington and New York, all those little houses? So, I'm looking out, and I'm reading the paper, you know, sort of half-baked doing it. There's another great word. It's a better word. And so, a much better word. Why are we hamstrung here, you know? It's not only our hams that are strung, Dad. It's a lot of things that are strung. So I'm reading this ad, and it says, this cemetery is for the living. This cemetery is for the living. I'm reading this, and the plane, and the wings. You know, have you ever noticed the wings flop on those planes? Well, yes, they flop very much. They flop up and down. And if you watch very carefully, you'll see that they flop in a sort of circular way. One goes one way, one goes the other. You know, they're just made by people. You'd be surprised, you know, just ordinary rotten people like you are. Yes, you know, sometimes they fool around with them. The moment you meant it, stop it. Oh, no, the moment you enter Mount Ararat, you know that you're here. That you are here. At last is a cemetery that cares for the living as well as the dead. The sweeping expanse of immaculate lawns, the smooth three-lane driveways, the meditation retreats, and other distinctive appointments all demonstrate this cemetery's sincere personal concern for everyone who passes through the gates. The cemetery for the living. Oh, boy, are we living in Sixville. Sing pretty good. You notice that? Yes, and also another thing that they guarantee you at this cemetery, which is for the living, is perpetual care. That's like 10,000 years from now. There'll be the same old man out there will be picking the grass, sniping the butts. And while we're on the subject of this wonderful cemetery, you know, it's for the living, I kind of like that thought. It says it's very close, very convenient to all bus stops. In case you want to, you know, that dying business just doesn't make it. You just... You know, dying has become part of showbiz anyway. This friend of mine has had a friend who was a musician, you know, and what he did really was he was just an arranger, and he, you know, there's a lot of friends knew him, and he knew him and all that, and so one day he heard about his friend. His friend had gotten hit by a 4,000-ton Mack truck, and that was the end, you know, just the end. Well, the sad thing about it was that he wasn't a very good arranger. So a couple of months later, he meets some of these guys who knew him, you know, friends. He says to these friends, you know, Charlie's dead. And one of them says, well, he never was much of an arranger. He says, no, he's dead. He's dead, you know. Well, that's what I said. He's not much of an arranger. The guy shouldn't have been in the business. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? You know, some guys can cut it, other guys can't. He says, no, he's dead, you know, D-E-D, dead. You know, with the lilies and that. He says, dead. Well, he wasn't much of an arranger. No, he says, dead. You know, he's gone, eternally gone. Well, it's showbiz, you know. It's part of it all. Hello there, living. Are you out there? Are you living? All right, all together now. That's number 17 in the book. There we go. Now stand up. You know, after you get tired, it begins to get you in the knee. There, are you okay? I mean, you know, it's very close to bus stops. And, oh, by the way, we can make arrangements for answering service. Hello? Yes, and time payments are possible there. And there's a perpetual with perpetuity. Can I find that about? Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're with it there. You'd be surprised how 36 hours of no sleep suddenly begins to give you perspective on this nutty world. I tell you, with an amazing lucidity, you begin to completely misinterpret everything around you. Which, I think this is... I think everyone deserves it to himself once in a while, just once in a while, to completely, thoroughly shudder, just to completely do away with his ordinary routine, shudder himself off from it. Now, most of us are hung up on sleep, like me. You know, it's funny. Do you know that I feel rotten unless I get at least, unless I get at least 20 minutes a day? I feel terrible. And of course, you know, if I sleep more than an hour and a half, I begin to have this logy, drugged feeling. And more than 3 hours, and just forget it. It's just everything begins to have a nice, soft edge to it. And everything begins, you know, you begin to accept things. You just begin to, you know, you sit down and people do things, you accept it. Like the other day, I'm sitting in Schrafft's. And, you know, there's a whole business of Schrafft's. Have you ever seen an emergency breakout in Schrafft's? Well, oh yeah, I mean a real emergency. I don't mean like they run out of marshmallow syrup or something like that. I mean a real emergency. Like the other day, I'm in Fifth Avenue in Schrafft's. And it's funny, you know, all of a sudden the word went through, there was a fire. It just went through like that. Of course, you can't tell really when Schrafft ladies are excited. You know, it's just a little ripple in the pond there. And there was a note that there was a fire, and all of a sudden I could hear all these girdles squeaking all around me. And, oh, it's terrible. All these ladies are jumping up. You hear the girdles squeaking. You can hear the hats rustling. And all these ladies, the shopping bags are squeaking. And they're all pouring out on Fifth Avenue. There's a big fire. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. I'll tell you, though, as long as we're talking about lack of sleep, and since we're on the subject, we might as well. Speaking of the sleepy, this is WORAM at FM New York, and we'll be here until midnight. Hey, are there any commercials in there, baby? None? Good. Well, I'll tell you a funny thing about sleep. I had a wild experience. Oh, you know, speaking of looking at the paper on the way back, this chick kept shoving papers in my lap. You see, what it was, it's got a lot of things going there with this stewardess business. And I couldn't tell, you know, it's a funny thing. We're sitting back, they have a little lounge in the back of the plane. Have you seen these little things where you can go and sit in back? And nobody ever seems to sit back in those things. And they're just sort of empty space that isn't used, so I clunk back there, and I'm working on this play. Oh, did I have a miserably embarrassing moment in connection with this play? I suppose some of you know that, or at least I suppose the rumor is out, that I'm doing Brigadoon, or I'm going to be in Brigadoon at the City Center. Here, we go into rehearsal the 15th of May, and we open the 29th of May, and I think we're going to be open until around the middle of June or something like that. But I had a terribly embarrassing moment with this thing. I'm up in Washington, and one of the official people says to me, oh, well, you know, they're making conversation. He says, what are you doing? Are you doing anything very good there down in the big city, in the theater, or anything like that? Very official. I says, well, yes, I'm appearing in Brigadoon. Which is this musical. You know, one of these little cutie pie things with the people jumping around with the kilts and all that. I'm in this musical in the City Center. He said, oh, well, by George, that's very good. I'm talking to an official type, you see. Very good. You're in a musical. I certainly love that kind of stuff. Gee, that's interesting. When's it open? I said, well, it's opening the 29th of May, and we're going to do this in the City Center. And he says, oh, that's wonderful. And I says, well, as a matter of fact, I see you have the New York Times over there. He has the New York Times piled underneath his desk. He says, you have the New York Times over there. There's an ad in the New York Times about it. That'll tell you all about it. He says, oh, well, sure. So he takes the New York Times. This is exactly what happens. A very funny thing. He took it out, digs out the New York Times amusement section for the past weekend. If you have it, you will see one of those rotten boo-boos that really tee off the little people. I mean, the little people. I mean, the little guys, you know. Anyway, he gets out this New York Times amusement section, opens it up, and there in this, you know, where they have all the ads for all the stuff, all these Ukrainian ballets that are continually plaguing the city are always showing up, you know, and the Ubitsian dancers are always coming into town, and all the way on down the line there, it says City Center, Brigadoon, opening the 29th of May, starring Sally Ann Hughes, Peter Palmer, and where my name is, there's just a blank. It has been blotted out. And he picked it up and he says, well, where does it say you? I said, well, there, it's a... I looked at it. It's just a blank in the ad. It has washed out in the ad. What is it? What has the Times got with me here? Last week in the ad, they misspelled my name. How would you like your name to be misspelled on the only poster you're ever on? Misspelled. So they get on to, you know, they call them up and they say, change the spelling, so they just block it out entirely. Well, we can't fool with little guys like this. And so he looked at it. It was very embarrassing, you know, with this official guy. He says, oh, well, it looked like I got no credit or anything. He says, what are you doing? And I says, well, I come in the end there, you know, I had the bagpipes and there's a funny thing I do with a tom-tom there. And I, you know, I do the kilt. It's a little thing I do with the Indian clubs, actually, in the last of the act there. He says, it's really very nothing. He says, oh, yeah, well, let me know sometime when you've got something big there in town. He says, okay. Of course, people live in this world by showbiz, you know. And I'll tell you an interesting thing, though, about people in the theater. It's just fascinating that most people I've known in the theater don't really believe they exist. They really don't, you know. It's a very unreal existence, and most of them walk down the street thinking somebody is following them, and the somebody that's following them is the real them. And whoever it is a garage mechanic. And it ain't whatever it is they're doing. Like playing Hamlet, say. And no, it's a very peculiar thing that goes all the way back to the earliest days when a guy decides he's going to go into the theater. It's a strange sense of unreality. And it's a sense that that they're going to get discovered any day now, and they're going to get sent back to the Bolton Nut Factory, where they belong anyway. And for then that reason, they begin to be hung up on things that are real, that they can show. There's nobody who collects clippings like people in the theater. Because you can, you know, you feel them. You can take them out, you can rustle them, and you can count them, and you can put them up on things in your room, and you can touch them, you know. And many people, I'm serious, to many people, the fact that they've got a poster that once said they did something is far more real than the memory they have of doing it. They don't really remember it. Because it wasn't real to them in the first place. And so they've got this big poster, and they say, oh, yes, Hamlet, yes, there, I see Hamlet there. See, on the sign there. That's me there, see? Over there, you see what my name is? That's me there. Oh, of course, yes, I did it. And it gets to the point where the unreality begins to be almost the only real thing in the life of these people. It's a fascinating thing. And so, in the end, they will argue. Oh, they will argue infinitely more over billing. Over where they're going to appear on the poster. It's too bad. I wish they would argue more about the plays. I wish they would argue more about the quality of the writing or the quality of the production. But what they argue about is the size of the type and the position on the page, the relationship to the title, the relationship to the other people on the page of the playbill or the whole business of the poster, until finally, way down at the bottom of the average theatrical contract today, you will see there is a long list of things about, and it gets very technical. They will use printer's language, the size of type, the ratio of size to the next guy. Now, it gets very involved, until finally, there are actors agents who are far more efficient. And certainly know a lot more about printing than they do about show business, and certainly about the theater. Oh, yeah, I got your 7-point type there with a number 3M with a 1/64th margin there between a number 7 paper there. It's a very good contract, very good contract. And we got your number 6 light bulbs there, just above the number 4 neon tube. That's with the number 7 indigo color there. It's a very, very good poster we worked out this time. And by the way, it's a pretty good show, I understand. It's not a bad script, actually, though. What we're doing is we're having it rewritten in the script department, but not really, because you see we're working on the poster here, and it's going to work out okay. Now, I called Manny the other day, and Manny he's got you in the Times, you know, this week. And, oh, by the way, Earl Wilson called, and Wilson wants to know... Incidentally, one more thing. When you see Kilgallen, when you tell her for crying out loud, why doesn't she get on the wire and give me a buzz? You know, I'm really... And when you see Arlene the next time, not at Sardi's, will you blah, 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 blah. Thank you. course, I know that this nice little lady in Brooklyn who will write to me and say, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, I realize, of course, that all the things you talk about are sheer balderdash, but I certainly find them very entertaining, and one of my favorite people, Mary Martin, I'm sure, wouldn't understand what you're talking about either, but on the other hand..." You know, I'm sorry, man. I know how it is. It's, you know, it's enough problem just being a woman. Without having to think, you know, all that stuff that goes along with being a human being, too. While we're on the subject of being a human being, I'm continually fascinated with the way things are going. A couple of months ago, I don't recall what senator it was. I think it was Senator Carl Mundt. I think it was Carl Mundt. You know, the one who looks so much like a dentist? He's almost a prototype for dentistry. You know what I mean by the dentist look? I don't have to tell you anymore. He looks like a dentist. Anyway, Carl Mundt, all right, you know what I'm talking about. You've known. I'm talking about the prototype dentist. Dentistry as a mystique. I mean, it takes somebody, you know, to get in there and start digging with the nut picks. Seriously, that is a kind of an attitude, you know. I know a dentist. I'd say there are two types of dentists. There's the one kind of dentist who plunges into his work with gusto, who really digs digging, if I might be allowed a phrase. He really enjoys the feel of the quivering bit in his hand. And he has a sense of accomplishment and a sense of excavation. And he loves to be packing people full of silver, trying to make them last another 10 minutes. Then there's the other guy who goes completely the opposite, who happened to have fallen into dentistry, if I may coin a phrase. And the next thing you know, he's knee-deep in impacted wisdom teeth. I would like to ask you one question out there. Have any of you gotten any good words recently from your wisdom teeth? Has your wisdom teeth recently sent you any profound knowledge that might be of some... Yes, that's just the truth. I have an impacted wisdom tooth, and I got all these ideas stuck down there, and I can't... But, no, there's another kind of dentist who has drifted into dentistry and has now realized what he's in. And you'd be surprised at the number of dentists who paint very flowery, very ethereal watercolors. Just they paint these ethereal watercolors that run heavily to elfin woodland scenes. This kind of thing. As far away as you can get from Tartar. About as far away as you can get. Excuse me, madam. I'm sorry. I wasn't talking about your condition. Come on, Eddie. Come on. Let's watch it here. Your condition. Right, there we go. All right. How is your condition? Everybody immediately says, "How did he know, the son of a gun? Your condition." Well, you see, the point is, you've got a condition. And there ain't no one dead or alive who hasn't got a condition. That's a condition of being alive, you see. It's a condition in itself. If you don't think so, ask John Updike. It's a condition. And once you accept the contract, you know, you got to accept all the small type. And once you start accepting all the small type, then it goes even further than that. You have to start accepting the conditions of the small type. And then, you see, you're beginning to work on the main line, the main river line of existence. Yeah, that's right. Oh, please, come on. Oh, don't bug me with that jazz, for God's sakes. All right, cut it out, you guys. Just a plain, blatant, bald attempt to curry favor. It's not going to do you any good up here. Well, you know, speaking of a guy sitting around blowing kazoos, I went to a strange party where there was a sense, you talk about total sense of unreality. Have you ever gone to a party where you have the feeling that everybody has gone to a party but nobody is at a party? And it's in a tiny room about the size of about four phone booths put together. And there's a lot of people standing around wearing girdles and very tight neckties and drinking beer. It's a very strange feeling. And in the middle of it all is some guy trying to get the thing going by playing a kazoo and also turning the hi-fi up high. They figure that by the higher the high, you know, higher the hi-fi gets, the more the hi-fi gets. And slowly but surely, people begin to drift out on the fire escape. And one by one, guys, well, I guess there isn't anything else to it, really. What more is there to life than a party? In fact, in many ways, a lady wrote to me about this. A funny thing about these letters. She says, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, don't tell the young people that there is no hope. Uplift them. Tell them to raise themselves on gossamer wings of faith and fly higher and higher into the sun. You just tell them this." All right, I've told them. All right, madam, now where do we go? Upraise yourself, kids. Gossamer wings, hope, fly. Okay? Higher and higher. You know, oh, that's great. Don't keep that one in abeyance, Eddie. Hold it. Hold it there. Now, just put that. There it is. We need a guy to sit there and blow that thing. It's funny how many people believe that by taking little pieces of paper that have various things that they should believe printed on them, by taking these little pieces of paper and passing them around, they then are fortified in their belief. And furthermore, it makes their belief real. You know, I'm suspicious. You know, when you talk about people, the showbiz people, who have to have clippings to prove that they really were in the show, that have to have clippings to prove that they really did exist, and who have to have the posters, you know that there are some people who are that way about their philosophy, whether it's religion or not. It's fascinating. I'm always suspicious of people who have to have all kinds of pieces of paper around them that say on these pieces of paper the things that they believe. You know what I mean by the tract syndrome? And until finally you get to the place where you meet little old ladies, you know, here we are, here, you believe it. And she's passing out a little piece of paper that and you say, well, madam, what is it you believe? And she gives you a piece of paper that tells what she believes on it. Now, the question is, does she really believe that or not, or does it make her feel that she believes it more because she's got it in her hand and she can feel it? That's fascinating. You know, there's a growing trend in our country that way of people writing books on things called "This Is What I Believe." And they write this long book on an economic theory or a political theory or a theological theory or whatever it might be. But the book usually has a very shrill sound running all the way through it. I believe this, you know, and I'll tell you why I believe this. I believe this because, once there was a man walking down the street in Cleveland, and he said to himself, "I do not have any hope. I'm not successful. I'm not successful, and I have just lost my wife, and I don't have any money." Well, one day he walked down the street in Cleveland, and all of a sudden he realized that he was wrong, and within 2 weeks he became a successful man because he believed. You see, that's what I believe. That's what I believe. I believe that. Oh, blow that thing, man. That's what I believe. Like, there's this note in the New York Times in the ad, the little ad, Addy ads, you know, the silly page of the Times on Sunday. In the one ads, it says, "Spontaneous group forming for jet round trip to London. Spontaneous group forming beginning next Wednesday." A spontaneous group will form next Wednesday at 2:30. Oh, how can you put it down, baby? Oh. I mean, there's nothing left. What are you going to do? You're shoving, you're pushing, you know. You wind up in the cemetery for the living. Dee, Oh, by the way, one of the most wonderful things about the Cemetery for the Living, in case you're interested, is that they will extend Diners Club card privileges. To, of course... Hey, watch! To, of course, the deserving. How would you like to find your credit is rotten in the Cemetery for the Living? Oh, come on, don't stop. Come on, get it's back there, the left shoulder blade, please. See, the difference between these guys and you is that these guys know something's after them. They only got 30 seconds to make it. Before it catches them. You see, baby, and don't come, you know, it's funny, and a lot of people will come back and yell at you, please, you know, you don't have any faith, you don't believe in anything. And the thing is that's my problem, probably. I do. Maybe if you could learn to do the right, speaking of doing the right things, of getting back to Senator Carl Mundt, do you remember a couple of months ago, Senator Mundt suggested facetiously, tongue-in-cheekishly, that we install... big loudspeaker systems with big hi-fi tapes out there on, you know, the big Mount Rushmore monuments where they have the big stone faces carved. And he says, what we ought to do is to have patriotic slogans and patriotic stories recorded by actors who are playing the parts of the people who are carved on Mount Rushmore. And I'm sure, you know, that you could hear the sound, 47 years ago, would be echoing out over the national park. And a lot of people began to take them seriously. You know, they're thinking, gee, that's a terrific idea. Until finally, you know, you can see in the Lincoln Memorial, you can walk in there and you can hear the sound of the stuff. Well, there is a little note that came out in the Newark News about this very thing. It's unbelievable. Have you ever been to Egypt, any of you? Am I the only guy who's ever been to Egypt? Well, yes, all right. So I've been to Egypt, okay. Well, it isn't what you think it is. There is a story in the current New Yorker, and I'm ashamed to say that I don't know who has been writing this series, but it's magnificent. It's a series on the Upper Nile in Egypt. And in particular, it is an account of one of the very first people who discovered discovered the antiquities as antiquities in the Upper Nile. This was a civilian who was with Napoleon's army. And he was describing going along the Nile. Of course, they were all dressed in French military clothing. They were dressed in serge, and it's fantastically hot. I can't describe to you how hot it can get in Egypt. But as they were going up the Nile in this desert region, he's looking out, and he could see all these monuments everywhere. And, of course, in those days, this was during the days of Napoleon, during those days, the idea of antiquities was not the same as it is now. These people just lived among them. They chopped them up. They used them for kindling. They would use them for doorstops, and it was nothing, just nothing, you see. So people were living among the great relics of the past, and he was fascinated. He would make sketches of this stuff. And there is a sense of the awe that he must have felt among all the sand and among this strangely desolate, beautiful country, to see these things rising silently out of the dusk. I'll never forget the first time I ever saw the pyramids. You know, it's funny. These are things that people all go to see as tourists. But there is an undeniable, peculiar quality about seeing these things, particularly if you see them at certain times of the day when all the rest of the stuff around them can be wiped out. You know, when you can get rid of the crud and the trivia of 20th century life, which inevitably grows up around these things. It's like looking at New York about 7 o'clock in the evening from across the river. You know, where you don't hear the cab drivers swearing, and you don't hear the fist fights going on in the IRT, and, you know, the whole business, and you can get away from it, and you can look across at this wonderful fairyland, this peculiar thing that we live in, this monument to us, this wonderful thing, this New York. Well, this is the way it is across the world when you come into areas where you are really confronted with something that is truly a monument. I think New York is a monument. It happens to be a living one, but it is a monument to something, and I don't know quite what it is, and I don't think anybody else knows what it is yet, because we're part of it. The monument is to a way of life. It's to a philosophy that's probably, for the most part, dead. It's to a romanticism. Have you noticed how the romantic attitudes have changed by just looking at the buildings? Take a look at the Chrysler Building, for example. Just look at the Chrysler Building. And then look at Lever House. Now, they're both, in a way, they're both, I think, clearly indicative of a time, a place, and an attitude. They're both beautiful in their way. You cannot argue that. Seagram's house is beautiful in its way. It's a beautiful building. And yet, there is a completely different attitude. You could not imagine the Seagram house, for example, having four gargoyles sticking out over the city. The only gargoyles that are in the Seagram house are way back on the third floor. When you turn left on the elevator, you have to go, you knock at the door, and you'll find them there, plenty of them. But they're gargoyles that are not, you know, it's a different kind of gargoyle. And another thing about the Seagram house, you know, it's funny that a building that is dedicated to booze, significantly enough, is one of the very few buildings in the entire Eastern Seaboard region that has sometime after we get off the air, I'll tell you about some of the plumbing facilities in the Seagram house. Very fascinating. yes, very fascinating. Highly unusual. However, it's part of a mystique anyway. But if you look over, just to look a little bit, if you're standing to the west of the Seagram house, you look a little bit to your right and you'll see sticking cleanly up in the air there, you'll see the Chrysler Building. Now, look carefully at the Chrysler Building once. This is from another age. And then look over at the New York Times Building, the Times right here in the heart of Times Square. This is another age. This is an age before the Chrysler Building. And you'll find that each one of these ages, even though their monument, whatever the monument is, has a certain kind of beauty, a distinct beauty to it. It is a very different kind of beauty, and also it shows a slowly declining, I suppose you might say, an outward show of sentimentality, romance, and in a way, a kind of emotionalism. The Seagram house is very unemotional. No question about that. And certainly, Lieberhaus is very unemotional. You can't say that about the Times. The Times building is a nervous building. It's got all kinds of little tassels hanging, you know, and it's got big spun pieces of concrete hanging out from the windows, and it's all clinging. It's sort of rolling. It's almost like Tchaikovsky music. I mean, it doesn't mind having a theme. It doesn't mind being sentimental. It doesn't mind weeping. Out in front of everybody, you know, just bawling all over the place, or laughing, or whatever it is it's doing. On the other hand, Chrysler Building is a little more, shall we say, self-conscious about it. And so instead of putting big marble gargoyles, it puts stylized stainless steel gargoyles, but gargoyles nevertheless. It's kind of saying, well, we got gargoyles, but stainless steel. They don't rust, you see. It's an attempt to try to make the totally impractical appear practical by making it out of...
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.